Let's go right to the message. All right, Isaiah chapter 33 and verse 22 once again says, "For Yahweh is our King. Yahweh is our, Yahweh is our judge. Yahweh is our lawgiver. Yahweh is our King, and He will save us." Glory, hallelujah. This will be, "You might be a Christian if," part 8. Or I might have titled it, "Asking and Answering the Right Questions." Or "Looking Through Yahweh's Eyes." There was a little boy who traveled back and forth on his own down the street to go to school every morning. There was one particular morning that his mother noticed the storm clouds beginning to build and got worse and worse as the day went on. And she got a little bit concerned because it started to thunder and lightning just a little bit. And so she got in her car and drove down the path that she knew her little boy would be on coming home from school. And she all of a sudden spied him down the road a little bit. And by that time, it was really getting to be very quite stormy, lots of lightning and thunder. And all of a sudden, there was this crack of lightning and thunder. And the little boy stopped in his tracks. And he immediately looked up into the sky and smiled. And she thought, well, that's odd. And little bit further on, so she's watching a little bit further on, the same thing happens. He does the exact same thing over again. And she's really puzzled. What is he doing? And she drives down to him, rolls down the window on his side, and she says, "Son, what are you doing every time it lightnings?" And she says, he said, "Well, God's taking my picture, so I'm looking up and smiling." What a difference. What a difference it makes when we view things through Yahweh's perspective. We see cameras instead of lightning. We see grasshoppers instead of giants. And we see what really needs to be done, instead of only halfway measures. We see, or at least hopefully we get a glimpse of the kingdom that needs to be so desperately restored in this day and age, or at least if not in this day and age, then in the generation of our children, the day and age of our children or our grandchildren or great-grandchildren. Rather than surrogate, what the kingdom is, it really needs to be as it's supposed to be restored if we hadn't given it away to the kingdoms, or we weren't teaching this kingdom off in heaven, which is foreign to the Bible, or some kingdom that's yet to be established in the future. And yes, it's in shambles right now, but it's not God's fault that it's in shambles. It's the Christians' fault that it's in shambles. They've given it away on a silver platter to the Antichrist. But only if we can get a glimpse, just even a glimpse. That's all I hope to do with this series, is to get a little bit of a better glimpse of what it means to really live like we should in the kingdom, rather than these surrogate political parties that at their best only further postpone kingdom living, at their best. Speaking of halfway measures, just before I preached this message at home that morning, or it was the morning before possibly, I was reading Psalms 106 and also Malachi 2, and I thought that they seemed especially apropos. Psalms 106, just a few verses from there, 29, it says, "Thus they provoked him to anger with their inventions." Now, we're not talking about machinery or anything like that. I think you can make the application here, particularly with this series, what needs to be made. But it included other things other than that as well. But it says, "They provoked him to anger with their inventions," 39 and 41. "Thus they were defiled with their own works and went a whoring with their own inventions. Therefore was the wrath of Yahweh kindled against his people, insomuch that he abhorred his own inheritance, Israel. And he gave them into the hand of the heathen, and they that hated them, and ruled over them." He turned them over because they went a whoring after their own inventions. And there can be dozens and dozens, maybe hundreds and thousands of applications to that. Turn to Malachi chapter 2. Malachi chapter 2, beginning with verses 5 through 8. And I've got a lot of ground. I've got at least a 60-minute message, and usually at home I'm trying to cram a 70-minute message in a 60-minute slot. Now I've got to take that 70 or 60 and try to slam it into a 50-minute slot, and it's going to be difficult. So if I'm already reading, you might just pause and listen if you're still turning. Malachi chapter 2. What did I say? Verses 5 through 8. Verse 5, it says, "And your eyes shall see, and you shall say, Yahweh will be magnified." Whoops, that's chapter 2, verse 5. "My covenant was with him of life and peace, and I gave them to him for the fear wherewith he feared me and was afraid before my name. The law of truth was in his mouth, and iniquity was not found in his lips. He walked with me in peace and equity, and did turn many away from iniquity. Verse 7. For the priest's lips should keep knowledge, and they should seek the law at his mouth, for he is the messenger of Yahweh of hosts. But ye are departed. Out of the way you have caused many to stumble at the law. You have corrupted the covenant of Levi, saith Yahweh of hosts. And that word corrupted could have been just as easily translated polluted or compromised. They had polluted the covenant. They had compromised the covenant. They had therefore corrupted the covenant as well. Now look at verse 9. Verse 9, therefore have I also made you contemptible and base before all the people, according as ye have not kept my ways, listen to the last phrase, but have been partial in the law. And note, it does not say they had been partial to the law. They had been partial in the law. And again, I would remind you of the last message that seldom was Israel ever judged for complete apostasy. It usually didn't happen. It was the halfway measures that they took, that they were partial in the law, that they compromised, they corrupted, and they polluted his ways. That's when they were judged. Because God, what I think, God wasn't about to allow them to completely apostatize. It was his grace that he judged them in their halfway measures. They were partial in the law is the same as to say that they picked through the law and chose what part of the laws they wanted to keep and what parts of the laws they didn't want to keep. Here a little, there a little. Precept upon precept. And by the way, I don't know how many times I've heard that passage used incorrectly. Isaiah chapter 28, verses 10 through 13. They take either 10 or verse 13, I forget which one it is, and our people have taken that, and I'm sure a lot of other Christians have as well, that precept upon precept, line upon line, and they say that's how we're to study the Bible. Go back and read the context. That's the exact opposite of what that passage is saying. It's talking about smorgasbord style Bible study, picking here a little here and here a little here, a precept upon precept that's here and everywhere instead of taking the context, like John is so apt to preach, from the context of the whole passage and getting it all as it's meant to be taken. And that's what they were doing, a little here and a little there, and they weren't taking all of God's law that John also spoke to you in the last hour about. And yes, I know that someone is very likely going to point out that passage in Malachi is talking about the covenant of Levi. Let me tell you, it's no different today under the new covenant. That is, if you understand what the new covenant is, which tragically probably 99.5% of Christendom today does not understand, even if they call themselves New Testament Christians or New Covenant Christians. Ask them the two most important questions about the new covenant, and I guarantee you they won't answer. I've tried it. Who the new covenant was made with and what the new covenant is. Hebrews chapter 8, ask them, and I guarantee, if you don't believe me, go ahead and ask them. But in Hebrews, as provided for us in Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 10, that is, as far as what the covenant is, it says, for this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith Yahweh, I will put my laws. Now keep in mind, that was written at the time of Jeremiah. The Hebrews author was quoting Jeremiah, and I've got to be careful, I'm ad-libbing so much, Jim, I'm not going to get this in 60 minutes. And I want to get all this message in, or whatever the Lord gives me to give to you. But anyway, keep in mind that was written the time of Jeremiah. There's no question what laws he's talking about. And he says, then this is the new covenant. I will put my laws in their mind and write them on their hearts, and I will be to them a God, and they shall be to me a people. His laws written on our hearts. The new covenant by which Christians are to live is the law of Yahweh written on their hearts, their minds and their hearts. Not to be justified, as it was under the old Mosaic covenant, but because we're justified. Not written on stone, but written on our hearts. Because God has justified us, and I have to serve him. And I have to keep his laws because I love him. The greatest of all commandments is to love Yahweh thy God with all thy heart, soul, mind, and strength. How do you think you do it? By keeping the first four commandments and their statutes and judgments. And the second is to love thy neighbor as thyself. How do you think you do it? By keeping the last six commandments and their statutes and judgments. The new covenant is the gospel, as I talked about in the last message. The new covenant is the gospel of the kingdom, the gospel of the government of Yeshua the Christ, his laws here on earth as they are now in heaven. You want heaven on earth? You think his laws aren't in force up in heaven? You think it's not heaven for that reason? If you want heaven on earth, we need to get back to his laws, his will, as he wants it in our lives. Amen. And any compromise by any church, preacher, political party is once again a case of being partial in the law and therefore under the same judgment we find there in Malachi chapter 2. You know, as noble as I believe, for those of you who know where this series is all about, as noble as I truly believe the intentions of the constitutional party are, they've nonetheless, unquestionably, been partial with Yahweh's laws. And that's again what this series is to hopefully for us to see, that we can't go around going to these different places where they're being partial with the law and expect that they're going to have the answers for this nation and our people. We've already seen this is true at this point in this series, those of you who have been following along with it, in a number of areas. Elections versus appointments. I'm talking about not just the nation here, but what the constitutional party would themselves promote. Elections rather than appointments. Juries governed by the whim of the people, even if jury nullification is in force, rather than judicial determinations according to Yahweh's commandments, statutes, and judgments solely. War is mandated by Congress versus war is mandated by Yahweh. We won't go there on that one. I'll get off on another sidetrack here. Or even the subtle promotion of pluralism versus the exclusionary practice of Christianity, among others. Some of them that we have yet to even talk about, and we'll talk about even some in this message. And let's continue with Chuck Baldwin's "You Might Be a Constitutionalist If." Number 9, you might be a constitutionalist if you believe the income tax is both unconstitutional and immoral, and along with the IRS, should be abolished. End of that quote. And I briefly addressed this area when addressing Baldwin's point number 3, but let me add some more comments to this particular one. To begin with, I want you to note not only what Baldwin said in that particular point, but also who said it. Because, listen to me, Baldwin is not your normal, or abnormal, depending on which side of the fence you're viewing things on, but he's not your normal or your average far-right extremist. Now, he may be right of a whole lot of others, but I'm talking about those they'd really identify as your far-right. You know who I'm talking about. But he's not your average far-right extremist out there that's saying that. He was the running mate of Michael Perutka, the 2004, I think in the last message I said 2005, but the 2004 presidential candidate for the Constitution Party. Again, the third largest political party in the United States of America next to the Republican and Democrats. That's who said that. And he and the Constitution and Party both recognize and blazon abroad that the IRS and the income tax are both unconstitutional and immoral. And by the way, so have many Republicans and Democrats. If I had time, I could share some of those quotes with you. Well, I'm going to share one of them with you. Even President Reagan said the following, quote, "Our federal tax system is, in short, utterly impossible, utterly unjust, and completely counterproductive. It's earned a rebellion, and it's time we rebelled." End of quote. Now, by the way, the initial rebellion tax rebellion in this country was over a 3% tax. And compare that today, when all is added together, of a tax upon us over 50% under our current King George. Which is still, I assure you, not as much as they would like. I don't know, have you seen the newest simplified 1040? I've got it actually a photo. You won't be able to see it if I hold it up, but I've got a actually reduced size of it, but it's the if you can see it, you can see it, it's right there. Simplified 1040. Part one, income, you fill it in. Part two, send it in. Three, if you have any questions or comments, please write them in the box provided. It's that big. Listen, a penny saved is simply government oversight. Now, as much as Reagan's quote, I'm sure, will probably surprise some people, I suspect the following will surprise a lot of Christians even more. And I'm not going to share with you who it is until at the end of it. And it's going to be quite lengthy, but there's a lot of good stuff in here. So please bear with me as I read this to you. And I didn't share all of it, but at least portions of it here. This was originally written in April of 1991. And it began, "Dear overtaxed friends, quote, this tax season brought to mind the shameful waste of our resources by irresponsible representatives in government. What they are doing is a national disgrace. Indeed, if the American people fully understood how their hard-earned money is being squandered and misused, they would certainly rise in revolt against the big spenders in Washington. Not only is Congress dissipating the great wealth of this country, but it is also robbing from future generations who are not here to defend their interest. Of even greater concern is my firm conviction that oppressive taxation is the most serious external threat to the institutions of the family." Later, he went on to write, "How do you feel about your taxes going to support the following studies? Nearly all of these projects were tucked within federal budgets during the past 2 or 3 years and have recently come to light. $566 million rising to $900 million later this year to send American cows to Europe to participate in an export enhancement program. And $49 million for a rock and roll museum. $1.9 million for an all-Ireland genealogy project. $5 million to help support Ted Turner's Goodwill Games. $2 million to construct and sail an ancient-style canoe to depict the migration of the native Hawaiians. $2 million to construct and sail this canoe. Well, I couldn't construct it, but I guarantee I could sail it for a whole lot less than that. Maybe I should sign up. I'd sail it for that. $15 million to the Dartmouth College as a part of the jobs creation scheme." Let me read that again. $15 million to Dartmouth College as a part of a jobs creation scheme. $15 million. You want to know how many jobs they created? A total of 39 jobs was created at a cost of $324,685 each of somebody's tax money. $1.36 million for preliminary work on an $18.6 million project to turn a Miami Boulevard into an exotic garden for people. $500,000 to study the effects of cigarette smokings on dogs. I'm going to put in for one on cats. This is all factual. I mean, this sounds almost too bizarre to believe. It's all factual. $107,000 to study the mating habits of Japanese quail. $19 million to study whether flatulence emitted by cows and other livestock harms the ozone layer. $84,000 to study why people fall in love. Like, we got that figured out. $1 million to study bicycling and walking safety. $160,000 to study food gathering habits of the Aki tribe in Paraguay. $50,000 to prove that sheepdogs do, in fact, protect sheep. I know you can't believe this is true, but it is. Well, you guys would believe it's true. $46,000 to determine how long it takes to cook breakfast eggs. I told my children, don't even think about it. I'm not paying it. $170,000 to fund a Dunkin' Donuts store in Lawton, Oklahoma. $6.1 million in search for extraterrestrial life. 90,000 to study the social and behavior aspects of vegetarianism. $219,592 to teach college students how to watch television. I think they got it figured out. I think the money would have been better spent how to teach college students not to watch television. And $25,000 to investigate the causes of rudeness, lying, and cheating on tennis courts. Continuing, for sheer outrage, however, it is difficult to surpass the activities supported by the National Endowment of Arts. You'll recall the intense controversy that erupted last year when the public learned the NEA regularly funded anti-Christian and obscene art. After fierce objections were expressed by hundreds of thousands of constituents, listen carefully, Congress debated the matter at length and decided to increase the NEA allotment by $4 million. This year, the agency will receive $175 million of taxpayer money. NEA Chairman John E. Frohmeyer says, quote, "I am not going to be the decency czar." You might remember him saying that back then, end of quote. Some recent NEA grants went to support the following activities. $15,000 to Holly Hughes, a self-described openly lesbian performing artist. Miss Hughes reportedly plans to portray female homosexual themes on stage in a performance with two 12-year-old girls. And I can't even read the rest of what he had in there regarding this in mixed company, where tax dollars were spent with the NEA. There's much more. That and much more was reported by that author in 1991, 14 years ago. And I know somebody said, well, you know, that's awfully dated. Dated quote there you have there, brother. Well, you can only imagine how much worse it is today. Because it's not got better. It's only got worse. But the principal reason I wanted to share that with you is because of the next quote and who it was who said it. Same author. Quote, "Let me return to the thought I expressed at the beginning of this letter. I love my country, and even with its faults and its self-serving politicians, it is the greatest nation on earth. What is needed to make it even better, perhaps, is a new Boston Tea Party." And he went on to say, "The last one occurred 218 years ago and was intended to protest taxation without representation. As it turned out, taxation with representation hasn't been so marvelous either," end of quote. And I would say it's worse. Now, anyone want to take a guess at who wrote that? That was James Dobson, president of Focus on the Family. Now, the reason it surprised me is because James Dobson has become a fairly adamant, rabid, almost, advocate of 501c3 corporations, of churches and corporations. And in fact, he makes no bones to say, because I am, there are things I cannot do that God would have me to do, although he doesn't add that part of it, because they tell me I can't. But back in 1991... was bold enough to write all of that. But let me tell you, the previous examples of government waste and abuse of American tax dollars is not yet even the worst of it. Because American tax dollars are not only finance billions of dollars in pork, but also some of the most abominable acts in the sight of Yahweh. I have a newspaper article by James Kilpatrick, you might remember him from the past, entitled, quote, "Tax money spent to encourage safe sodomy." I have a National Rights to Life advertisement that pointed out that at the time it was published, that $250 million was used to pay for abortions. That's their terminology. I don't use that terminology unless I have to. To pay for infanticide. That's the term we should be using. That's the only reason Roe versus Wade was won, because they used some semantic engineering on us. Abortions are simply miscarriages. Had they been ruling, had it never made it to the courtroom, had they been dealing with infanticide as it should have been dealt with. But excuse me, I did leave out one important little word in that advertisement. It wasn't just $250 million that was used to pay for abortions, or infanticide, excuse me. It was $250 million tax dollars that were spent to finance countless cases of infanticide. This was the ad, by the way, for the purpose of electing George Bush. And in that same ad, it was also pointed out that, quote, the next president will appoint up to four new Supreme Court justices, and the U.S. Senate will confirm or reject them, end of quote. And therefore, that, quote, the next president and the U.S. Senate will decide whether millions of lives are saved or the killing continues, end of quote. Sound familiar? It should, because the same arguments were used to elect and re-elect George Bush Jr. And the killing continues, just like it did in his daddy's reign of terror. Here's another news article entitled, quote, Taxpayer Funds Nation's Largest Abortion Provider, as they put it, by Samuel E. Castor-Schmidt from Reclaiming America. A little bit lengthy again, but please bear with me as I read it to you. Taxpayers fund nation's largest abortion provider, Monday, January 12, 2004, so just not all that long ago. Do you pay taxes to the federal government? If so, your tax dollars have helped to sustain an organization that aborted, let's just put it like they should have put it, murdered, an average of 623 unborn babies each and every day throughout the 2002 calendar year and beyond. The 2002 to 2003 annual report for the Planned Parenthood Federation of America, PPFA, reveals that the nation's leading provider of abortions, murder, performed 227,385 surgical murders in 2002. In addition to these surgically aborted babies or murdered babies, the organization is assuredly responsible for the deaths of many more, having distributed 633,756 morning after pills. Incredibly, this annual report also reveals that they collected $254.4 million from the federal government. Under a heading, Planned Parenthood Makes a Killing. During the most recent fiscal year, PPFA recorded $766.6 million in total revenues. Of that, the American tax dollars, pro-life and pro-abortion alike, provided roughly one-third of these revenues. Incredibly, at year's end, Planned Parenthood turned in a $36.6 million profit, which will not revert back to the federal budget. Rather, these leftover subsidies will remain on their books as a part of the organization's total assets. As of June 30, 2002, before the latest annual report, Planned Parenthood held assets valued at $771.4 million. Under another heading, Planned Parenthood insolvent without federal subsidies. Without the revenues attributed to government assistance, PPFA could not maintain its current impact upon American culture. In 2002, the organization would have racked up a deficit exceeding $217 million without taxpayer assistance. Such deficits as Planned Parenthood would be commonplace if left without government grants each year. In fact, if the government had existed free from government subsidies from 1995 to 2002, it would have racked up over a $1.19 billion in debt. Without this government aid, Planned Parenthood's impact in America would be severely diminished, if not permanently destroyed. Instead, pro-abortion legislators have volunteered our tax dollars to propel the pro-abortion agenda, and Planned Parenthood has prospered with more than $377 million in profits since 1995, which has allowed them to saturate the nation with additional abortion clinics. End of that quote. And by the way, there has been more provided to Planned Parenthood under the reign of George W. Bush than there was under President Clinton. So much for our pro-Christian president. Now, Christians, understand that abortion is infanticide. But what's happened is that they've been removed from it. They've been distanced from it. And consequently, most of Christendom has not connected the dots. Christians would agree, that it would be wrong, absolutely immoral, ungodly, for them to perform an infanticide. And I would think that they would agree that it would also be wrong for them to pay someone to perform such acts of atrocity. But what about paying someone to pay someone to do the same thing? I want you to think about it. I want to think about Christendom as a whole here. Just think what would happen if all of Christendom or the majority of today's pastors were to connect those dots and the implications therein, and to do then with those connected dots what they really need to be doing. And sharing it with their congregation and saying, this is the stand that we need to make. Think what would happen. And what's Reclaiming America's answer? Quote, do not allow your tax dollars to sustain an organization that is responsible for the death of more than 3 million unborn children. Please sign the death and taxes do not mix petition, which will be delivered to Congress. Call and write your elected officials in Washington and ask them to sponsor and support legislation that will remove federal funding from Planned Parenthood. End of quote, U.S. Capitol switchboard, and they provide the number. The same old that hasn't worked to date, and the killing continues, no matter whether the government is controlled by Democrats or Republicans. But what if the constitutionalists were elected to the presidency? You know, I hope that things would dramatically change if that were to happen. But I hate to say it, I really, really doubt that it would, because not only would it require that the president and the vice president be constitutionalist, but also the majority of the senators and representatives and the U.S. Supreme Court justices. It's not going to happen. And they're kidding themselves if they think they are. They're not all of a sudden just going to turn it over to them. And I'll say it again. They are the best choice out there right now. And if I can make it happen, I'd certainly at least want to get back to what they have in mind. At least it's partway back to where we need to go. But it ain't going to happen. Because even if someday, the Constitutional Party candidates were elected president and vice president, they will still have to play according to their rules. It's the system that's faulty, imperfect, if you will, in comparison to the perfect laws of Yahweh, the perfect kingdom of our God that He provided us. Thanks. Now let me go back to that. It's the system that's faulty, that's imperfect. Thanks to the Constitution of the United States of America that chose imperfection over perfection, having been partial in the laws of Yahweh. Is it better than what we have today? Hands down. Hands down, yes. But we're in the state we're in today because they were partial in the laws of Yahweh. Moreover, and once again, you do not, as I pointed out in many of the messages on other points, you do not have to be a constitutionalist to know that the IRS and income tax are immoral. Chuck Baldwin's number 9 again. Quote, you might be a constitutionalist if you believe the income tax is both unconstitutional and immoral, and along with the IRS should be abolished. Here's my initial email response. You might be a Christian if you believe income, property, and all confiscatory taxes are both unbiblical and therefore immoral, and along with the IRS should be abolished. Now, I hope, I really sincerely hope that a whole lot more people will figure out that the income tax is unconstitutional. I hope they do figure that out. But more important for Christians, or at least it should be, is that they figure out that it and property tax and all confiscatory taxes are unbiblical. And that the only biblical tax to run the nation, the only biblical tax is a tithe on one's increase. And if you don't have an increase, then you didn't have a tax. And also that they figure out what Thomas Jefferson once wrote, he said that, quote, to compel a man to furnish contributions of money for the propagation of opinions, and I'll add, or especially actions, which he disbelieves and abhors, is sinful and tyrannical. End of that quote. And yes, it's true. The Bible says to pay taxes to whom taxes are due. Romans chapter 13, verses 6 and 7. To ministers of God for our good, and who are a terror to those who practice evil. Romans 13, verses 6 and 8. Verses 3 and 4. Not to those who finance terror upon the most innocent of the population of our people, the unborn in their mother's womb. Yes, taxes are due to whom they're due. And he makes it very clear to what type of government leaders that they're due to. And therefore, and therein, to whom they're not due to. Now, for those who haven't figured out what the Christian's response to Yahweh in this regard should be, I recommend that at the very least you take the following action, which is, I'll assure you, is heads and shoulders better than reclaiming America's Sign Our Petition. Quote, attention, IRS. This was a letter purportedly written to the IRS. Attention, IRS. Enclosed is my 1998 tax return and payment. Please take note of the attached article from USA Today newspaper. In the article, you will see that the Pentagon is paying $171.50 for hammers, and NASA has paid $600 for toilet seats. Please find enclosed 4 toilet seats, value $2,400, and 6 hammers, value $1,029. This brings my total payment to $3,429. Please note the overpayment of $22 and apply it to the Presidential Election Fund, as I noted on my return. Might I suggest that you send the above-mentioned fund a 1.5-inch screw? See attached article. HUD paid $22 for a 1.5-inch Phillips hand screw. It has been my pleasure to pay my tax bill this year, and I look forward to paying it again next year. Sincerely, a satisfied taxpayer. Pretty good idea. All right, enough on that one. Let's go on to another one. Chuck Baldwin's number 10. Quote, you might be a constitutionalist if you believe. And again, for those who weren't here, I'm not attacking Chuck Baldwin. This is just simply a great forum for us to really learn what kingdom living is really all about. Chuck Baldwin's number 10. You might be a constitutionalist if you believe the federal government had no authority to tell Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore that he could not display a monument containing the Ten Commandments in the Alabama Judicial Building in Montgomery. End of quote. Keep in mind, those of you who have listened, it was a 30 question commentary, which I failed miserably. In fact, there wasn't one of these I got right. You may think, well, that sounds good. Well, here's my email response. Quote, you might be a Christian if you believe that all American justices, not just Judge Roy Moore, but that all American justices should be enforcing the Ten Commandments and their respective statutes and judgments, and that any judge who refuses to do so should be immediately removed from the bench. The constitutionalist response is retain Ten Commandment Judge Roy Moore on the bench, whereas the Christian's response is remove all anti-Ten Commandment justices from the bench. That one deserves something. Amen, it does. Remove them all. Lord willing, someday. And someday I think it's going to happen too. By his power and his grace and mercy.
Much due to the judge that removed more.
We'll deal with that another time. Thank you. If someday it will happen. When Christendom finally figures out what it really means to claim Yahweh Yahshua as Lord, King, Judge, and Lawgiver. When they really figure out what that means. In the meantime, don't forget this, that they do sit on Moses' seat. And therefore, whatsoever they bid you do, that is, in accord with the laws of Yahweh, and there are some cases where they're still doing that, you do those. But do not according to their works, for they bind heavy burdens grievous to be borne, and they themselves will not move them with one of their little fingers. Chuck Baldwin's number 11. You might be a constitutionalist if you believe that neither Congress nor the White House nor any sovereign state is required to submit to unconstitutional Supreme Court rulings such as the Roe versus Wade decision. End of quote. My email response was, quote, you might be a Christian if you believe that no one is required to submit to any unbiblical court decision such as Roe versus Wade, and that any judge who makes such a ruling should be immediately removed from the bench. Such as the federal judge who recently, you might have read about it in my home state of Nebraska, who recently overturned the gay marriage ban there in Nebraska. Remove him from the bench immediately, without hesitation. He's proved himself unworthy. And let me add this to the discussion. The Constitutional Party's platform on the judiciary, under the heading the judiciary, you can go to their webpage and you can find this. I won't be reading all of it, but at least part of it. Under the heading the judiciary, quote, the United States Constitution does not provide for lifetime appointment of federal judges, but only for a term of office, end of quote. Again, we've got to start thinking in the right parameters. Again, much of this sounds so good and so right. You know, yeah, let's not let those guys stay there. But I say, why not? Why not a lifetime appointment? Why not if they are biblically qualified men upholding and executing Yahweh's judgments upon criminals? Why wouldn't we want them serving as long? The Constitution says no. But why wouldn't we want them serving as long as they were able and willing to serve in that capacity, if that's the kind of judges they were? Patriots and others are often, over the years I've heard many say, are often promoting term limits. And I agree wholeheartedly when it comes to scoundrels we've got in office today. You know, I recommend that their terms be limited to no term whatsoever. But listen to me. When we have biblically qualified men, when those men are in office, term limits are anti-biblical. And yet the Constitution would promote otherwise. Proverbs chapter 28 and verse 2. Listen, it says, for the transgression of the land, many are the princes thereof. But by a man of understanding and knowledge, the state thereof shall be prolonged. You don't get rid of such a man. You beg him to stay in office.